From Williamsport to Latrobe, Carlisle to Erie, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Governor Josh Shapiro has delivered his annual budget address to a joint session of the Pennsylvania legislature. Difficult negotiations lie ahead. Greg Moreland from the National Federation of Independent Business joins us with analysis. The taking of a property's equity above what is owed for real estate taxes is once again an issue headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Kathy Hoekstra and Christina Martin of the Pacific Legal Foundation discuss the case on this week's edition of American Heroes. And it was another Groundhog Day as Governor Josh Shapiro gave his annual budget address calling for yet another massive spending increase. Emily Bry from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Greg Moreland from the National Federation of Independent Business in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Governor Josh Shapiro has raked in tens of millions of dollars in out-of-state campaign contributions for his re-election campaign. But news that one of his top contributors is prominently mentioned in the recently released trove of documents related to the Epstein scandal took the spotlight away from the governor's budget address. State Treasurer Stacey Garrity, the presumptive Republican nominee to challenge Shapiro in the general election, was quick to pounce. Garrity called on Shapiro to return over $2 million in contributions tied to Reid Hoffman. Reid Hoffman is co-founder of LinkedIn. He was mentioned over 2,500 times in the newly released files. Garrity has already been pressing Shapiro on his failure to adequately address a sexual harassment scandal tied to one of his cabinet secretaries. Garrity said, quote, "Accepting donations from Jeffrey Epstein's associate is the latest example of Josh Shapiro turning a blind eye to female victims," end quote. A number of special elections will be held over the coming months for vacant seats in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. Several members resigned to assume other offices to which they were elected last November. Last week, State Representative Seth Grove, a Republican from York County, resigned to take a new job in the private sector. A special election to fill the reliably Republican seat will be held on May 19th, coinciding with a regularly scheduled primary election. The leading candidate to replace Grove at this point appears to be George Margetis, who currently serves on the Manchester Township Board of Supervisors. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, passed by Congress last year, created a new federal school choice tax credit program. The legislation requires states to opt into the program, which allows taxpayers to direct contributions to scholarship organizations and in return receive a tax credit on their federal tax returns. To date, 27 states have opted into the program, but Pennsylvania is not one of those states. Governor Josh Shapiro has ducked the question. Shapiro has consistently been hostile to providing educational options outside of traditional K-12 government schools, going so far as to veto funding to provide scholarships to mostly minority students in the state's most failing school districts. And so we wait. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Governor Josh Shapiro has once again delivered his annual budget address with the expected proposed massive increase in state spending. Here to parse through the governor's proposals is Greg Moreland. He is Pennsylvania State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Greg, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Greg, the National Federation of Independent Business here in Pennsylvania, you had your annual economic forum here this past week. Always before the governor gives his budget address, you actually provided facts and data. Tell us a little bit about the forum. What was the purpose of it? Who did you have?
Yeah, so I think it's a really good event to have, and it really shines a light on the true numbers, right, of where the Commonwealth has been, where the Commonwealth is, and where we're headed. And so we had Matt Niddle from the Independent Fiscal Office, a tremendous mind. They do great work over there, providing real-life data to the elected officials and to others in the Commonwealth that are interested in economic policy. We also had the Department of Revenue to speak on the Working Pennsylvanians Tax Credit, and Minority Chairman of Appropriations, Jim Struzzi. You know, I think what the theme of the day was is that Pennsylvania is really at a crosshairs right now. We are at a crossroads of we are either going to tax our individuals and our businesses more, or we're going to bring our spending plan more in line with our revenues. We cannot, and none of my businesses can operate by outspending the money that they're bringing in the revenues, right? You cannot run a structural deficit every single year and be successful in business. On the other hand, government appears to be doing just that. We are going to be left with a $4.5 billion structural deficit in this year. We do not have the funds, the revenue, to continue down this path, yet the spending just continues to get greater and greater. And so the purpose of this event and the Economic Forum is to shine a light on where we have been, where we are, and where we're going, and to look down into the numbers. Workforce participation rates, how do we compare? Policy, how do we compare? Where are the revenues coming from? Where is the growth coming from? It takes a holistic look at all of our workplaces and economic development policies and really tries to highlight what is working and what's not working. And what's not working is the overspending coming out of Harrisburg.
I've always been impressed by the work of the Independent Fiscal Office. And Matt Kittle, I thought, did a great job for you, Greg. He, in fact, disabused some of the assumptions that were made. Of course, we heard early last year in 2025, tariffs are going to make inflation go out of control. They're going to raise prices. A lot of the statistics that he showed us showed that tariffs and inflation, et cetera, did not have as draconian an impact as what everybody was concerned about at the outset.
No, if you would have watched the mainstream media, the sky was falling, everybody was going to go without paychecks, we were going broke as a country, and everything was on the wrong path, right? But what actually played out is not that at all. The stock market is doing great, people are making money in retirement accounts, the interest rates are coming down, in fact. I think we are heading towards more predictability for our small business owners as some of these tariff arrangements are coming to fruition and these countries are coming to the table to negotiate with the president. And so I think what was once thought to possibly be long-term pain caused by the tariffs turned into maybe very short-term disruption or no pain at all. And so I think ultimately at the end of the day, our business owners see what the goal is. We want to repatriate businesses back to the United States. We want to have it made here in America by Americans. And if we do that, there are many small businesses that are spurred off of the heels of these large businesses coming back to the Commonwealth and back to the United States. And so what was once thought to be poor public policy, again, turned out not to have the impact that many of the mainstream media and folks were rallying behind. You know, it's kind of, they rallied behind the inflation was transitory several years ago, but then we found out inflation wasn't transitory and it was here to stay for quite a while. But thankfully, President Trump is the one to put these businesses back into the rightful place, back into here to America with the threat of tariffs.
And so as we start seeing manufacturing and other business interests reshoring to the United States, Greg, is Pennsylvania poised to take advantage of that? Do we have regulatory and tax policies that will incentivize these businesses to move here rather than, say, the Sunbelt states, where most of them seem to have gone in recent years?
Unfortunately, I would say the business climate here in Pennsylvania is kind of lukewarm at best. We have an overly complex regulatory network, around 167,000 individual regulations on the business community that is far greater than many other states in the nation. I believe some other states have 20 to 30,000 regulations. And not to say that regulations are a bad thing, when they're done properly, they're a good thing. They put guide rails on certain industries to ensure that people are protected and all that good stuff. But when you have regulations on top of regulations that need another regulation, it becomes overly complex. And for the small business owner, they don't have a legal department. They don't have an HR department. The owner is all of those individuals. And so it becomes an incredibly hard path to navigate. And so we have done well. The Republicans, about 4 years ago, the Republicans passed a corporate net income tax reduction. It amazes me that Governor Shapiro gets up there and claims that he cut taxes seven times. But when you look at when that bill was actually enacted, he's only been sitting in the seat while the tax cut occurred. He was not the reason for the tax cut. The tax cut was driven out by the Republican General Assembly. And so that's the truth, is that the taxes were cut by the Republicans, not Governor Shapiro. And so while the corporate net income tax is being reduced from 9.99 all the way down to 4.99.5 each year for 10 years, I think that will bring business back to the Commonwealth. Even at a 4.99, I still would argue it's a little bit higher than I would like it to be. We would like to see our personal income tax come down just slightly as well, providing meaningful tax relief to our constituents and small business owners as well. But I think we are primed and ready to accept those businesses if we do the hard work of legislating. And it's hard work, and there needs to be consensus, but we need it to be done. We need regulatory relief.
We are talking with Greg Moreland, who is state director of the National Federation of Independent Business. They had their annual economic forum this past week. Also this past week, Governor Shapiro gave his annual budget address, a wish list, a Christmas list of items that he would like to see. Interested in your thoughts, the governor again proposing significant increases in expenditures. How does that relate to the proposed or the projected revenue that we're likely to get?
Unfortunately, if you were at home yesterday or on Tuesday, February 3rd, you probably, if you are a layperson and you don't follow politics and policy very deeply and are intertwined with policy, the speech sounded good. He is a good orator. He can speak very much Obama-esque, but then you actually have to peel back the layers of the onion and look at what he's saying. And when you do that, you find that it's not based in reality. His spending plan is a wish list. It is far greater than the revenues that the Commonwealth is bringing in. You cannot spend $53.26 billion, a 5.4% increase over the current fiscal year, without having at least $53.26 billion in revenues. And unfortunately, we do not. We are running about a $4.5 billion shortfall again. We are going to run a structural deficit. And his solution to this is to transfer $4.58 billion out of the rainy day fund to the general fund to make up for all of this spending. That is like wiping out your 401k to pay a one-time, to pay your bills off right now and to leave yourself with absolutely nothing for the future. That is what he's doing. He is bankrupting the Commonwealth. He is bankrupting us on his way to an inevitable presidential run in 2028, where he doesn't plan on being in the Commonwealth when taxes are going to have to be raised because we have no revenue.
Well, let's face it. Last year, we had an extended budget stalemate in Harrisburg, and they sort of rummaged through the couch cushions and came up with enough money to cover that $5 billion in deficit spending. Of course, now the couch cushions have been raided. You mentioned they're going into the rainy day fund. As they continue to increase spending, Greg, how long is the rainy day fund going to last before it's exhausted and now we're stuck with this huge structural deficit? How do we pay for it?
So the only reason we have over $7 billion in the rainy day fund is due to the pandemic and responsible governing. Responsible governing by the legislature at a time when they realized that there were headwinds coming our way. In the Republican-led legislature, in the aftermath of the pandemic, and even before the pandemic, started putting monies away into the rainy day fund to ensure that if, when, in the future, we needed it, that those monies were there. Governor Shapiro, in a one-stop shop here wants to spend about 60% of all of those monies, $4.58 billion, leaving us with only about 40% of the monies that are currently there in the rainy day fund. And so while we're going to spend $4.58 out of the rainy day fund this year, it's going to leave us with little to go off of for the following year. And that is going to lead to a tax increase. There is no government doesn't make widgets and sell widgets. They can't just sell more widgets next year and make more money, right? They get their money from our people, from the people that work and live here in the Commonwealth through taxation. And when you don't have enough revenues and your only revenue source is taxation, there's only one place to go once you've spent through all of the money.
Greg Moreland is State Director of the National Federation of Independent Business for Pennsylvania. Greg, tell us a little bit about NFIB and where can we find you on the web?
Yeah, absolutely. NFIB.com. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization representing about 13,200 small businesses all throughout the Commonwealth, all sectors of the economy. We are the voice of small business, and we are here to advocate for our business owners to be able to own, operate, and grow their business free of intrusive government interference. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing nowadays, intrusive government interference. And so organizations like ours are very much needed to take the story of the small business owner to their elected officials, because it is one of the most impactful stories. We have folks that have put everything on the line to start a business, and we want them to be protected. We want them to be commended for taking that risk and employing their neighbors and their communities. And so we're here to fight. NFIB is a fighter.
Greg Moreland of the National Federation of Independent Business. Greg, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Lemon.
How much of a property's value can be taken in payment for back real estate taxes? That legal question is headed to the Supreme Court of the United States. On this edition of American Heroes, Kathy Hoekstra and Christina Martin of the Pacific Legal Foundation discuss the case. Kathy?
If you or I fall behind on our property taxes, the government is allowed to take and sell our home to collect what we owe. We may not like it, but it is true. What the government can't do, though, is keep every cent of the sales surplus. Yet local governments across the country did get away with that for years. And even after the Supreme Court said home equity theft is unconstitutional, some states are still finding ways to keep what isn't theirs. And some states, like Michigan, are completely abandoning their lawful duties whatsoever. And that's where the Pung family comes in. This Michigan family is bringing their fight to the United States Supreme Court on February 25th. Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy Hoekstra with Pacific Legal Foundation, and this is American Radio Journal. Joining me today is PLF Senior Attorney Christina Martin. She has successfully fought home equity theft for more than a decade and is now standing with the Pungs as co-counsel. Christina, thank you for being here, of course. Before we get into the legal side of all this, tell us a little bit about the Pung family. Who are they?
The Pungs are a family in Michigan who faced predatory treatment from their local government. Rather than the government simply collecting property taxes, the local government ignored the law and ended up imposing a $1,600 tax on the Pungs' home that never should have been imposed. The Pungs had paid all the taxes that were rightly imposed, but the county then used that tax to confiscate not just what's owed, technically, but to confiscate the Pungs' entire home worth almost $200,000.
Yeah, that's crazy. And as a result, Mark and Tia Pung and their young son were actually evicted from their home. They lost their home, but it wasn't just the home. They tried to fight back. And tell us what unfolded there. They lost really the equity in their home. It was worth $200,000, and they lost a huge chunk of that over what started as, you know, $1,600, really. So tell us what unfolded there.
Yeah, so the Pungs paid all their taxes that were properly imposed, but the tax assessor had ended up retroactively revoking an exemption for owner-occupied homes. The Pungs challenged that revocation and ultimately won. After the tax tribunal had ruled for them, though, the tax assessor mailed out a bill with the next year's taxes and the exemption applied, but then when they showed up to pay the bill, the county had again revoked it. There's a lot of disagreement about what exactly happened after that in terms of notice and conversations, but there's a few things that everyone agrees about. First, the tax assessor was wrong. That $1,600 tax never should have been imposed. Second, the Pungs didn't pay the improper tax, but they did pay all their other taxes every year. And yet Isabella County ended up foreclosing on the home anyway. The county waited until after they got a foreclosure judgment. They waited until after the time to save their home had expired to let them know that they had a foreclosure judgment from a court. After the county took title, the county didn't let the Pungs save their home by paying the tax with interest and fees. Instead, the county fought the Pungs in court to confiscate their entire home. The county later sold it in a fire sale auction for a fraction of its value, about $76,000 for an almost $200,000 home. And the county kept every penny. The Pungs had to bring a constitutional lawsuit against the county, which they partly won. But the court held that the county only had to return the surplus proceeds from the auction. That meant the county had destroyed over $118,000 of the Pung family's equity.
And Christina, this is not your first home equity theft related case. You began this crusade, boy, more than a decade ago. And in 2020, the Michigan Supreme Court said unanimously it's illegal for the government to keep more than it's owed in property tax foreclosure sales in a case that you brought that began with an $8.41 tax debt, which is crazy. Then 3 years later, you argued Tyler v. Hennepin County, Minnesota, at the U.S. Supreme Court, which also agreed unanimously. Now, after Tyler, many states did do the right thing and change their laws to protect property owners' rights to their home equity. But some states, as we mentioned at the beginning, did start down a different path. And this case of the Pungs in Michigan, it's a totally new wrinkle that the Pungs are taking to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court obviously felt it was a big enough wrinkle that they need to hear it and address it. And they're asking, for our listeners, two crucial questions. When the government sells your home to collect a small tax debt, does it owe you your property's fair market value? Or can it lowball the sale and keep the difference? And when does taking vastly more than someone ever owed, or as in the Pung's case, never actually owed, cross the line into an unconstitutional punishment? Do I have those questions right?
For the most part, that's correct. The bottom line is the county only returned $76,000. And the question is that unconstitutional? Did the county violate the takings clause or impose an excessive punishment? And we think that the county did.
Okay, so that $118,000 is really a punishment, an excessive fine.
Yeah, the county, remember, originally took the entire home and deemed it forfeited. And now they've only returned a fraction of the value of the home. And we're saying, look, you never should have foreclosed in the first place over such a small debt, improperly imposed tax, an unnecessary foreclosure, and then you sold it in this way that brought in a fraction of its value. That's not just compensation. And if it is just compensation, it's an excessive punishment.
Yeah, absolutely. And a win for the Pungs would put governments all over the country on notice that, you know what? They better take a close look at their tax foreclosure process and be ready to protect owners' home equity. Well, Christina Martin, thank you so much for all you do for standing with the Pungs and homeowners across the country. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And to learn more about the Pungs case and PLF's continued fight to end home equity theft of all varieties, visit pacificlegal.org. I'll be back next month with another courageous American hero. I'm Kathy Hoekstra for American Radio Journal.
Governor Josh Shapiro's budget address included many recycled proposals that have failed to gain traction. Emily Bry from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, talks about it on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
This week brought us Groundhog Day, a tradition built around a furry prognosticator and the idea that we might wake up to the same exact day again and again. If you tuned in to Governor Shapiro's budget address that he delivered earlier this week to a joint session of the General Assembly, you might have felt like you've already lived this moment before too. Just like the movie Groundhog Day, where Bill Murray's character relives the same day on repeat, Harrisburg seems to be stuck in a familiar cycle. Once again, the governor rolled out a budget with big spending priorities, new programs, and calls for investment into already heavily funded broken systems as everyday Pennsylvanians struggle to make ends meet. In his speech, Governor Shapiro spends a lot of time talking about Pennsylvania, quote, on the rise, citing record investments in public schools, tax cuts for seniors, apprenticeships, and economic development initiatives. He touted progress on workforce numbers and permits processed, and he emphasized cooperation between parties in passing budgets that, quote, solve real problems. However, underneath the upbeat language, the fundamentals of this year's proposal feel awfully familiar. More spending, more government programs, and more pressure on taxpayers' wallets. While the governor highlights incentives for workforce development and economic growth, the overall picture remains one of expanding government involvement rather than real structural reform. Certainly, elements of this budget proposal seem well-intentioned. Who doesn't want better schools, safer roads, and more opportunities for Pennsylvanians? This week's Groundhog Day moment, however, reminds us that well-intentioned rhetoric doesn't always equal results, especially when taxpayers are left to foot the bill for nearly the same government-centric approaches we've seen year after year. Even when the governor talks about efficiencies, like reviewing state agency space and sunsetting duplicative programs, the headline takeaway is still a government budget that grows layer upon layer without asking tough questions about how or whether these dollars will yield better outcomes. While the political elites talk about building on a foundation of so-called progress, everyday Pennsylvanians are juggling their own budgets at kitchen tables across our Commonwealth, wondering why more spending and higher costs are always the go-to answer. Governor Shapiro's budget may have new packaging, but to many it feels like a rerun rather than a real reset. As we think about Groundhog Day and the memorable movie loop, the real question for Pennsylvania is this: when will we break the cycle? When will we see real accountability, fiscal restraint, and policies that put working families first, instead of repeating the same tax and spend playbook yet again? Fortunately for you, taxpayer activists, we're working every day at Americans for Prosperity PA to fight back against rampant spending that's become entirely too pervasive within the halls of Harrisburg. Join our fight. Take action today to urge your members of the legislature to work within our means to balance our budget. Head to afppennsylvania.com to learn how you can join our fight for more and end this cycle of rampant spending for good. This is Emily Bry, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. It is time to talk about the 2026 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the premier grassroots activist event of the year. This year's Pennsylvania Leadership Conference will be held April 9th through 11th at the Penn Harris Convention Center in Camp Hill. This year's featured dinner speaker will be Chris Ruddy, the founder and CEO of the Newsmax Cable Television Network. Washington Examiner columnist and Fox News contributor Joe Concha will be the conference luncheon speaker. They will be joined by a wide array of speakers, panel presentations, and an expanded menu of workshops. Complete information and registration for the 2026 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is now available at paleadershipconference.org. Join us for the conservative event of the year, the 2026 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference. Again, registration is available at paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the cost of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Frederick W. Anton III Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. Thank you.